So we last week we did some exploring about this idea, this Michael Polanyi idea of tacit knowing, and at the heart of that exploration was, I think, an experience that most of us have in common, which is that we all know things that we can't convey in direct or explicit ways. Some of those are very ordinary things, like riding a bike or speaking a language or driving a nail. We spent a lot of time on driving a nail, as I recall. And we did a little bit of considering about how many of the things we think of as spiritual might fall under that way of knowing, what Polanyi called tacit knowing. And poked around a little bit in how that can be uniquely challenging and frustrating, especially if we want or feel a need to share those things with other people, because they don't share easily. You can't make them concrete and hand them along like you can with a discrete piece of knowledge. And sometimes things that matter a great deal to us are things that we want to share with others. We want to share them with our friends, with our colleagues, with our family, with our friends, with interested conversationalists, with life journey partners. There's things we want to be able to share. And in part, we did that exploring in the context of what Paul writes in Romans 12, 2, where the text says, "Do not conform to the pattern of this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind." A well-known text, probably to lots of people. It's an interesting sentence in its structure. It's quite distinctly two parts. Do not conform to the pattern of this world, comma, but be transformed by the renewing of your minds. So we've got a comma and a but, both to set these things into two clear parts. I want to jump in there again, but I want to really focus today on part one, do not conform to the pattern of this world. And if you're already twitching because do not conform to the pattern of this world has been something that's been used to clobber you, just relax. We're not really going there. Well, we're going there, but in a way that offers a critique. How about that? One of the songs that Tim and Jane have brought into our community that I just love is this wonderful Alan Sparhawk tune, "Some Holy Ghost," which we sing together once in a while. Sparhawk is the guitarist and male vocalist, the front vocalist. There's also a female vocalist. Do you call a person who is an important vocalist in a band structure but is a drummer a front person? Anyway, Sparhawk is the guitarist and the male vocalist of this American indie rock group, Low. And they're from just across the border, actually, in Duluth. As is often the case with songs, there's no way to really kind of know the specifics of what the songwriter had in mind when they wrote something. But whenever I sing the verse that says, "I don't know much, but I can tell when something's wrong and something's wrong," I can't help but imagine being an American and looking around your nation at the current state of affairs and thinking, "I don't know much, but I know when something's wrong and something's wrong." And of course, that's not a uniquely American experience. You could even say, perhaps, that it's the pattern of this world, to use the language of the text, the biblical text that I just read. Not everything is right. Something is wrong. And not just somewhere else either. Something is wrong here, there, and everywhere, and you don't have to be a genius to see it. In fact, we could consider that it takes a fair bit of determination and I think even convoluted denial to think otherwise. When I was reviewing what I'd written about that, it occurred to me that I'd written all of that early in the day on Monday, before somebody drove a rental van down a couple of blocks of Yonge Street in Toronto. That song doesn't have very many words, but it says a lot. And I think from my vantage point, it's in the careful restraint of the writer, the songwriter, to not say everything is wrong. Something is wrong. Enough for me to tell, And that is the case in enough different situations and iterations for me to think it's fair to say that something is wrong might fairly be called part of the pattern of this world. By the way, not every religion has the Christian perspective that has running in the background this idea that everything should be or shall be right. Buddhism, for instance, has a robust understanding of the place of suffering in the pattern of the world, and there is a lot to learn from that perspective. The idea that all shall be well and all shall be well and all manner of things shall be well is, if not uniquely Christian, then predominantly Christian. I want to spend a little bit of time on this phrase, do not conform to the pattern of this world, not least of all because lots of us in this room have probably primarily encountered the phrase being used as kind of a biblical lever for a certain set of values. The pattern of this world has often, in many of our experiences, I suspect, been a setup for so-called Christian values, which on closer examination often reveal themselves to be nothing more than the prevailing middle-class cultural norms, baptized by religion and set up as working examples of what is wrong with this world, with the pattern for something negative. And the real kicker, I think probably if I polled the room, the real kicker for many of us has been what I would call the parental voice. Sometimes actually parents within a family, sometimes religious leaders within a religious subculture, using that don't be conformed language to reinforce whatever value they're on about, but doing it in a negative way, as in don't think that way, don't do that thing, don't behave like that, don't have that attitude. That last one's a beauty, right? Don't give me that attitude. That's just conforming to the pattern of the world, and the Bible says that's wrong. Now, of course, there are patterns of thought and patterns of behavior that are discernibly a problem, and to conform to them is just to perpetuate the problem. Any pattern of inciting hatred or bigotry comes to mind, as do patterns of thought and behavior that put me first at the expense of other people, alongside the sort of patterns that turn a blind eye to systemic injustice and oppression. All of those, though, are really broad paradigms, right? And discerning what's going on and then trying to figure out and then live in ways that assail those broken patterns and also that operate in ways other than that, that's way harder than just saying, don't do that. And doing that kind of work, the kind of work where we actually are going, okay, there's a pattern here in me, in the world around me, in the wider culture, globally, whatever sort of range we're observing or reflecting at, there's a pattern here that is destructive that needs to not continue. To get from there to how do I live different than that moves us from one space to another. And one way to think about that, and I'm going to spend a little bit of time on this morning because I've found it instructive, and I hope I can convey it in a way that might be helpful to us in thinking about this. When we start to move from that kind of 30,000 foot critique to how do we live different, one of the things that tends to do is it moves us into a space where we're operating in a more adult relationship to the problem and less of a child relationship to the problem. And I'm going to define those terms in a little bit. I want to spend a little bit of time on this idea of parentalism today because I think it can provide some helpful insight. Now, depending on your own educational or personal journey, some of you might have already recognized that I'm just dipping my toes into the edge of a psychoanalytic theory, a big batch of psychoanalytic theory that's broadly understood as transactional analysis. The short version, because this is a wide realm of psychoanalytic work, the short version, though, is that a person named Eric Byrne, who was writing in the late 1950s, believed that we could gain a better understanding of our own behaviors by analyzing our social transactions, the way we interact with other people. So we could actually understand something profoundly significant about ourselves and our behaviors as humans by observing how we interact. So our social transactions. And if you've ever read about or heard about or been involved with, and this is a long list, but just see if you're on it in any way. with cognitive, behavioral, relational, redecision, integrative, constructivist, narrative, bodywork, positive psychological, personality, adaptational, self-reparenting, psychodynamic, or neo-constructivist ideas or therapies, you've been working with this body of work. So it's got a pretty big sweep in terms of contemporary theory. And one of the things that Byrne did that I think captured the popular imagination, because it was an accessible idea, is he mapped our interpersonal relationships to three of what he called ego states. And those ego states were parent, adult, and child. And in Byrne's model, those are not chronological developmental stages. It's not like we move from one to the other in some tidy sequence. They are ways of acting and interacting with others. Emotional responses to whatever situation we're in. And I want to mention all of that theory this morning because I think it can help us take a different view of this don't conform to the patterns of the world idea. In Byrne's model, those ego states are not only not necessarily sequential, they're also not right or wrong. We tend to move in or out of them in different circumstances. So we can be a chronological adult and find ourselves moving around inside those different ego states depending on the situation that we're in. Having said that, it's important to recognize their characteristics so we can identify how we're behaving. Why am I behaving this way emotionally? Why am I reacting or having this emotional experience in this situation? But also so that we can move toward adult ego states as we mature. So there is an unfolding of this in terms of maturation in the model. And I expect that many of us have had, and perhaps still have, religious experiences where our learning and growing has been negatively impacted in a way that this model can help us make sense of by parentalism and our reaction to it. Most of us know what it's like to have what Byrne would have called a compliant child response to an authority figure. I know that in myself, I tend to see this most readily, and I fall into it most unconsciously and quickly with authority figures that remain generally regarded as sort of legitimate authorities in our culture. So for me, this is with a cop. Yes, officer. No, officer. I'm sorry, officer. Just comes out of me without consideration. And there's a part of me that goes, oh, this is just me being self-serving. I'm just trying to talk my way out of a ticket. That's a really tidy explanation until I back away from it and realize inadequate. Might be true, not good enough. So that's where I kind of go, oh yeah, boom. Why am I behaving like a child in this situation emotionally? Why am I reacting with that kind of compliance? And I don't know if you've had occasion in your life to be around people that have had lots of interaction with the police, and perhaps especially interaction that hasn't been even-handed. But when I'm in those situations, I find myself almost like, and maybe actually, I'd have to really pay attention to know this, but holding my breath, because what sometimes comes out of those folks in those situations is the other child ego state, which is the rebellious child, the fuck you child, you know? And they'll get in the cop's face. And I'm like, you know, somebody's going to get shot here. And I'm the innocent bystander. I'm not liking this experience a bit. Sorry, officer. Let me explain. You know, let me comply. Let me try to fix this. My compliant child just cringes from the rebellious child in those situations, just wants to get out of the room. And those two, compliance and rebellion, are the two typical modes of child response to what Byrne called the parent mode. The parent mode is a mode that expresses itself, in Byrne's definition, through superiority or criticism. It majors on shoulds and oughts, and verbal put-downs are not an unusual methodology in that mode. So that's what I'm calling parentalism, this approach of superiority and criticism, and I'm here to tell you what you should do. The third ego state is the one that Byrne calls the adult, and obviously a desirable state in the model. This is the state, the emotional or ego state, which is the pattern that emerges in our behavior when we feel accepted on equal terms, or when we feel respected or listened to. So more on that in a moment. But let's go back to that experience of religious sort of parent-child mode. I suspect that many of us know what it's like to be in a religious environment where We've been told not only what to believe, but what behavior that belief equals. Not just what to believe, but how to behave. And I'm not talking in this instance about suggestions. I'm talking about being told this is right, that is wrong, and these are the consequences of disobedience, some of which, by the way, are eternal and ultimate, in a superior top-down sort of way. Now, if we're having an experience like that, how might we respond to that sort of experience? Well, in a typical early going, the response would likely be compliance. So early in a faith journey, early in the unfolding of our development in a faith context, if we grew up in a religious environment or faith sort of based environment, often the first response would be compliance. We're the learner. The authority figure is the teacher. Our job is to learn. Theirs is to teach. And so we fall into that model and we learn. And that's there's something about that that makes a lot of sense. In a lot of ways, if we think about this as adults, chronological adults who are dealing with chronological children in our lives, we kind of go, that's an ideal teacher-learner situation. That compliant child response makes that person very teachable. They learn stuff. And we've got stuff that we need to teach them. It works, right? Here's the problem part. To put it really simply, when we have that kind of an equation, the child responder is not just learning the information, but they are learning that compliance is the right response in a spiritual setting, in a religious setting. So they're not just learning religious information, they're learning compliance in lockstep with learning religion. So we learn that compliance is the right attitude religiously. And those things are so fused together that we can't pull them apart very easily. Sometimes we need to pull them apart because that's not always the right mode for faith. So what happens when we start to become self-learners and we realize that some of what we've been taught in particular doesn't sit well with us, doesn't work with us, doesn't have the ring of truth about it, might have revealed itself in a variety of ways to be short-sighted or false or self-serving, but we start to have collisions with the information that we took in when we were in the compliant child mode as a learner. What happens? The dissonance goes through the roof, is part of what happens. Because we no longer know how to operate in that setting, in that frame. The way we learned that stuff was the compliant child. And now we're starting to have experiences with the things we learned that don't fit well, and we don't want to comply with them. They don't work for us anymore. The problem is, if we've been trained to respond in a religious setting in child mode, we feel like we only have two options, either comply, the one that worked, or rebel, the one that didn't work. And there's nothing in the middle. And that, I just feel like I have this conversation, one of the reasons I'm intrigued with this model in this setting of ideas is because I feel like I have hundreds of conversations that I can think about in my life where I've talked to people who have had this experience of what was handed to me no longer works, and I feel like I only have two options. Either I comply or I rebel. But there's nothing life-giving in the middle. I can't comply anymore without blowing up inside or living a dual life. I have to pretend I agree with this, you know, on Sunday, because that's what compliance looks like, right? But during the rest of the week, I'm like, man, that's screwed up, right? Or I can rebel and say, that's just screwed up, in which case the environment that says you have to comply to be a good religious person says, we don't know what to do with you, and I don't have community anymore. I don't know about you, but I feel like I know way too many people that are chronological adults and who live in an adult ego state in the rest of their lives. They think for themselves, they take responsibility for their own actions and decisions and beliefs. They move through the world with, more often than not, a sense that they are equals with those around them. But when they show up at church, it's like they walk through a portal on the way in that switches all that off and turns them into compliant children. And when it comes to moving toward acting like a spiritual adult, neither the compliant child mode nor the rebellious child mode are especially helpful. They're both basically defenses against the imposition of authority, which sometimes we need, but which we also need to learn to move beyond. Which brings us back to, do not conform to the pattern of this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind. A mind that is occupied with either compliance or rebellion is probably not all that available for renewal or growth or transformation. It's just, the space is occupied. So if we think that having a renewed mind mostly means don't think that, as defined by a parentalist authority figure, we're in trouble right from go. And to stay in that space is to define what we are supposed to be if we're being transformed as people, primarily by what we are not supposed to be. Don't be like you were, is the short version of that model. If we're going to put it another way, to understand our renewed mind mostly as one that shouldn't think the way that it used to, and that's a space that's more likely to trap us in a negative loop of don't think that, don't do that, than it is to open into one where we can explore with freedom and imagination. It's really hard to crack this without becoming conscious of it, without kind of acknowledging some framework for it. And part of the reason Burns' theory reveals to us, part of the reason for that is that we aren't always aware of the ego state that we're in. We're not necessarily thinking about ourselves that way. And so we're not necessarily coming into a faith setting or into a spiritual conversation paying attention to what state we are having that conversation in. But if we grow up under religious parentalism, I know what's right, and I'm going to tell you what's right, and I'm going to tell you what the social implications of it are, how to act it out. If we grew up in that environment, we need to learn to be conscious of those things, because the odds are better than fair that we're in that environment, we fall into that ego state. We start to behave like compliant children, even though in all the rest of our life, or much of it, we don't operate that way. Well, how problematic is that? Pretty problematic, I think. Are there things about our minds, about how we think, that need to be changed, that need to be renewed, that need to not be like they were, to use that equation? Of course there are. It'd be ridiculous to think otherwise. I mean, all I have to do to probe this in my own life is ask myself, have I ever been, for instance, paralyzed by my own patterns of thought about what I would call greed? I want that. I don't care what it costs. Or have I ever found myself stuck in a loop that when I stand back from it, I realize that's about self-interest. That's about me first at any cost. Or do I ever find myself dealing with kind of the gridlock in my own psyche that comes from objectifying other people, or whatever else falls under, I can tell that something's wrong. I don't know much, but I know when something's wrong, and something's wrong. Yes. Anybody here ever had any great success with being transformed in any of those kind of things by chanting the internal mantra, don't think that? It's like, let's not talk about pink elephants. Let's not talk about pink elephants. Don't visualize a pink elephant. Right? We get stuck in the wrong loop entirely in this. You don't have to answer it. It's a rhetorical question, obviously. But by way of contrast to that way of thinking, what I want to do to end our time today is just list some possible qualities that we might expect to find in a mind that's open to being transformed. So the other side entirely. Not a don't do that side, but a look for these qualities and see what you can do to nurture this and foster this. And props to a British writer named Dave Tomlinson, who set me off on the path of these ideas many years ago. I'm as grateful now as I was then. It makes sense to me that a mind that is seeking to be transformed is going to be an open mind. And by that, I mean honest. I mean willing to constantly reconsider its own position and condition. Now, the idea of constantly being open and reconsidering your own condition and position, if you come from an authoritarian or a parentalist experience religiously, one of the critiques you would hear if you said that immediately is, you mean gullible. You mean wishy-washy. You mean you don't know where you stand. That's the answering critique. And in fact, what I'm trying to describe here is almost the opposite of that, because an open mind thrives on doubts and questions, but it isn't ultimately governed by them. It's not afraid of them. It doesn't need to be afraid of them because they're not ultimate. They're pieces of something. So they can be intriguing even when they're troubling. We don't have to fear them. It's an open mind that can approach a world of possibilities, including spiritual possibilities, with the attitude, everyone is my teacher, and there's always something to learn here. But if it's in an adult ego state, it's still a mind that knows in the end that it is responsible for its own processes and its own choices. No, I might not be behaving around some particular ethical issue or moral issue or social norm the way that you do. But I am an adult, and I am responsible for my choices in this. And so unless we agree to have a dialogue about it, how exactly is that a vertical or authoritarian concern of yours? It isn't, unless I let you make it so. I'm responsible for that choice. I'm responsible for that decision. That's what it means to be an adult. Yes, I was going 65 and a 50. True story. I honestly, internal integrity, thought it was a 50. And so when the guy handed me the ticket, I had a proud adult moment with a cop. I looked at the value of the ticket, which was approaching $300. And I said, that's a lot for five over, because I know I was going 65. He said, no, it's not five over. Shows me the gun. You were going 65. I know I was going 65. Oh, it's a 50. Oh, I thought it was a 60. Well, he says, I'll make a note on the ticket that you thought it was a 60. Thank you. You know what happens when you take that to traffic court, right? They say there's signs posted everywhere that say the default speed limit, urban speed limit is 50. You're responsible to know that as a driver. Here's your ticket. That was my ticket. I was going 65. But I didn't have to crawl under the seat and cringe. I just had to own it. I'm responsible for that. The fact that I had my 17-year-old who's becoming a driver in the next seat to me might have added a little impetus to behaving while I don't know exactly. I get lost when I try to do self-analysis of that moment. We're responsible, and that means we're free to explore. We just have to own that. And it seems to me that a renewable mind is one that is open to creative, and I'm going to say lateral possibilities, and credit here to Edward de Bono, whose book Lateral Thinking sort of rocked my creative world a decade plus ago. De Bono's research basically was demonstrating how easily we get trapped in mental ruts, how easily we get, even creative ruts, we get trapped in patterns, basically, and we kind of default to that. And as we've been poking around in this the last couple of weeks, particularly last week when we considered some of the implications of tacit knowledge, the importance of things we know that we know but that can't be summed up well with words or passed along as concrete knowledge, when we think about that and we think about a rut, it's easy to step away from those things and from trying to convey them because we have to live into them to convey them. Lateral thinking, De Bono would say, is putting together thoughts or concepts that we might have previously considered incompatible. So the idea of sharing something that we know, but we cannot make into a discrete piece of knowledge to share, those things might have seemed incompatible. And then somebody said, wait a minute, we do share them. We share them all the time. So how are they getting shared? And did that research, and that's where we got Polanyi's work on tacit knowing, that we share them by living them with people. And that includes living questions that we have, not just answers that we have. So as parents, when we're going, how do I share my spirituality with my kid when my spirituality is in full revision mode? Well, I share my in full revision mode spirituality with my children. And as somebody who's lived through that and who continues to live through that as a parent, I got to tell you, you got every reason to be hopeful if that's your situation, that your child will be able to say to you of their spirituality, I'm not really too concerned about the fact that I don't know X or Y. I'm figuring it out. I'm working on it. It's all right. It's okay, because my parents are working on it, and they still love me. The world's okay. It's all right. So different from I know what is right, and I'm going to tell you with authority what is right, and your job is to comply. I can clearly remember really recently being exposed to this sort of fear-based argument that right belief is not a cafeteria. You know, you don't just get to go through and pick what you want. Anybody ever heard that one? Humility alone should remind me that I need to learn from others, and that the idea that I'm somehow part of a tradition that has a corner on doctrinal or religious purity is just indefensible. It's absurd. I have found think bigger a far more compelling idea than believe right ever managed to be for me. It doesn't have to be everybody's story, but certainly been mine. I also think that to have a renewable mind is to have a mind that is reflective rather than just accumulative. I don't think this has ever been a more important idea than it is now when our access to information is practically unlimited. It seems to me that in many ways we face almost the opposite challenge, which is to continue to be reflective in the face of the knowledge that there will always be more to reflect on, that we can't ever reflect our way to an end point. It just keeps coming. There's just more to think about. There's just more to muse about, more to reflect on, more to parse. I feel like in my life experience these days, I feel like I'm watching a lot of people give up on learning how to think and settling for just sort of acquiring skills that are necessary to make a living. And that is not me slagging making a living. We need to do that, and skills are important and valuable. I'm not trying to denigrate any of that. And I wish to say that there's a lot more to life than that. We can be highly skilled people for whom an idea like hope or meaning is utterly empty. And it's the work of being reflective that will help us to be aware of and inclined to work at those questions. So this is not about being either a scholar or a technician, because it's possible to be a scholar and not be a reflective thinker. Tim and I were having a conversation, Tim's a scholar, we were having this conversation just a couple of weeks ago about this thin slice of the wedge idea can have in academic work, has this kind of ferocious downside where we can become, by requirement of our occupation, or at least by pressure in our occupation, know more and more about less and less, and that's the path to success in the field, but it doesn't necessarily foster learning how to think. And you can be very successful academic and never have been pushed toward deep reflective work. You can also be a deeply reflective scholar. You can also be a deeply reflective technical person. These are not antithetical. That's the point that I wanted to make. There are some ways that we can check in with ourselves to see if we're developing a reflective mind, a mind that's open to that kind of transformation. And this is not my list of questions, but I like it. I'm gonna pass it along. I find it helpful to remember that if I'm wondering if I'm doing reflective work in my life, I can ask myself questions like this of myself. Do I challenge current prejudices? Do I disturb the complacent? These things can be internal and external, of course, right? These things could all happen inside of me just as well as outside of me. Do I question the foundations of what is all around me? Do I throw doubt on the aims, motives, and purposes of those in power? Do I question the things that a busy pragmatist, whether that's me or somebody else, has neither the time nor the patience to investigate? I recently read someone that suggested we could sum all of this up by asking myself the question, am I a nuisance? Because to have a renewable mind is to be a pain in the butt to those that would rather not think, but would prefer to heedlessly comply. It's true. Reflective people disturb the status quo. Last one. I think that a renewable mind is inclined to be holistic. We touch on this in lots of ways here, so this will be brief. To have a holistic mind is to make things like emotion, intuition, mystery, tacit knowing, equal partners with rationality. We still live in an age that privileges reason and the rational. There are ways in which that's unraveling as we see that the results have not been necessarily predictably awesome, but it's still dominant, I think. And to only work from the faculty of critical reason is to be a person that's in danger of having what I think we could call a false consciousness, because always favoring the rational can make us vulnerable to reductionism, to taking ideas that should be expanding ones and codifying them and enforcing them as right belief. And most of us in the room have encountered this in the world of religion. A big, complex human problem or question. There's something wrong with the world. The pattern of the world is not everything is right. Big, complex problem. Big question. And reducing it down to a narrative storyline that says it answers that question in its entirety. Do I have to be explicit? The first two chapters of Genesis do not answer all the aspects of the question, what is wrong with the world? I'm sorry, we don't get to take a brush that's labeled the fall and use it in a way that is dismissive of reflective, open-minded consideration of the complexities of what's wrong with the world when not everything is wrong with the world. Not if we want to have minds that are open to transformation and renewal, we don't. If we want to comply, if we want to fall into a storyline and just sort of settle in there, we can do that. It's one of the options that's available to us. But if we want to be transformed, it doesn't work that great. I'm not talking, by the way, here about being irrational, but I am talking about not worshiping the rational and instead being open to cognitive contributions from the non-rational part of our honest, open, and sincere exploration of what is good and right and lovely and true. I think that we live in an incredibly exciting time in this country, even in this room, I hope, in the sense that I think the invitation to explore what we believe with minds that are open to renewal and transformation has arguably never been more available. We do not live in an age where in the majority of the settings where we live our lives, we have to believe X and Y and practice it in very particular ways in order to not have our lives be in danger or our livelihoods be in danger or even ultimately ourself be in danger. We have remarkable freedom. If we give it up, I would say that we have no one to hold responsible for that in most circumstances but ourselves. I want to add the qualifier. I know it's not always that simple. But oh my goodness, we got a lot of room to run. And if we are not people with minds that are open to being transformed, partly because somebody said to us somewhere back along the way, what don't be conformed to the world means is don't, instead of explore, then we should just do some work with unraveling that message, with getting that tape to just shut up and let us run with the room that we've got. That's a choice, of course. And one that, if it's really going to work, I think has to be something that we're willing to take on in a, to use Burns' language, an adult sort of ego state, as people that are prepared to own what we discover for ourselves rather than handing it off to external authorities or structures, including God. This is our work to do. I said we were going to explore an often misunderstood parable. We're not going to do that today because of time. But next week we're going to pick it up there, and we will consider a parable about a not religious but spiritual seeker and an evangelical pastor. Bet you didn't know that was in the New Testament. Anyway, it is. And so we'll have some fun with that next week. Peace.